Welcome to the podcast. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com. Today we'll be talking about plastic products containing bisphenol A and what we know about the science of plastic safety. On the call today we have two speakers, both conveniently named Steve. They are Dr. Steve Henches and Dr. Steve Novella, along with an audience of medical bloggers including Jean Ostrovsky, Dr. Harriet Hall, Dr. Rob Lamberts, Barbara Ficaro, Terry Pollack, Dr. Edwin Leap, Phil Bauman, Dr. Tony Brayer, Dr. Ramona Bates, Dr. David Kroll, and Dr. Brian Vardabedian. I'd like to begin by reading a short introduction to our speakers. Dr. Steve Henches is the Executive Director of the Polycarbonate BPA Global Group of the American Chemistry Council. In his current position, Dr. Henches has been deeply involved with the science on bisphenol A for more than 9 years. Dr. Henches holds a PhD in organic chemistry from Stanford University and has also conducted postdoctoral research at the California Institute of Technology. Dr. Steve Novella is the founder and executive editor of Science-Based Medicine. He is an academic clinical neurologist at the Yale University School of Medicine. He is also the president and co-founder of the New England Skeptical Society, the host and producer of the popular weekly science podcast, The Skeptic's Guide to the Universe, and the author of Neurologica Blog, a daily blog that covers news and issues in neuroscience, but also general science, scientific skepticism, philosophy of science, critical thinking, and the intersection of science with the media and society. So first I'd like Steve Henches to offer us a 5 to 10 minute introduction to bisphenol A, then I'd like Dr. Steve Novella to respond and ask some questions, and finally I'll call on each audience member to ask at least one question of either Steve, so please have those ready. So, Steve Henches, welcome to the call. Please set the stage for us.
Appreciate the opportunity to speak to all of you. Usually I find myself speaking to journalists, and it's a particular pleasure to be able to speak to an audience that has an interest in the science. And I'll spend most of my minutes talking about that, but first I wanted to spend a couple of minutes giving you some background information on BPA. What is it and how it's used? BPA is a chemical that is primarily used to make two things, polycarbonate plastic and epoxy resins. And at the outset here, I think it's important to understand that BPA is chemically reacted to make those materials. And what that means is that only trace levels of BPA remain in the finished products, in the finished plastic and resins made from BPA. So that's very important because it really isn't possible then for consumers to contact any significant level of BPA from use of consumer products that are made from those materials. And when I get to the end of my little talk here, I'll tell you more in a little bit more quantitative way about human exposure to BPA, what we know about that. You, I think, know that there are a variety, quite a few different plastics that are manufactured commercially, and each of them has a somewhat unique set of attributes or properties that make them useful in some applications and not so useful in others. So what is polycarbonate? Well, it's a lightweight, clear, and highly shatter-resistant plastic, and that combination of attributes makes polycarbonate very useful in a wide array of consumer products that you no doubt use every day, even though you may not know they're made out of polycarbonate. For example, eyeglass lenses, sports safety equipment, things like football helmets or bicycle helmets, blast and bullet-resistant shields, CDs and DVDs, and some reusable food storage containers all are made from polycarbonate plastic. Epoxy resins are completely different materials. They're very durable. They have high chemical resistance and good adhesion. And that combination of properties makes epoxy resins very useful as protective coatings, usually on a metal surface. For example, you would find them protecting steel pipes and fittings, structural steel, things like the steel that you would see on a bridge, or automobile bodies, protecting those metal surfaces from corrosion. Perhaps one of its more important uses is that epoxy resins are very widely used, almost universally used, as the protective coating on most food and beverage cans. And in that application, the coating protects the safety and integrity of the product, the food or the beverage, by preventing the food from contacting the metal surface. Many foods, if they do contact a bare metal surface, whether it's a steel can or an aluminum can, would result in corrosion, leading to contamination of the food with metal and potentially contamination with bacteria. And those are potentially real serious food safety issues. So in this application, epoxy resins play a very important role in protecting the safety and integrity of our food. food supply. So let's switch over then to the safety of BPA. What do we know about that? First, these are not new materials. BPA, polycarbonate, and epoxy resins have all been around and used commercially for about 50 years or more. And during that time, in particular in the last 10 or so years, BPA has become one of the best tested substances in commerce. And what that means is that we have an extraordinarily rich scientific database to assess the safety of BPA. Sometimes you'll hear about numbers of studies on BPA, and literally there are many hundreds, probably thousands of published studies that report some kind of data on BPA. And the reason for this very high level of interest from scientists and also government bodies is because of the hypothesis that very low levels of BPA may be harmful. Well, what do we know about that? Well, first, we do know that BPA is weakly estrogenic. For example, if you test BPA in a cell culture, you can demonstrate that BPA will have a very weak estrogenicity, weak compared to something like estradiol, a natural estrogen. But the important question is really not whether that weak biological activity translates into a health effect in the body, and in particular at the very low levels of BPA to which people are exposed. And this is a very controversial question or hypothesis due to a very high volume of conflicting data. And since we only have a limited amount of time today, I'm certainly not going to be discussing hundreds or thousands of studies individually. But instead, what I'll do first is really jump to kind of the bottom line. I think it's maybe most important to know that this extensive science on BPA has been reviewed comprehensively by quite a few government bodies around the world, in particular just in the last couple of years. So, for example, in North America, Health Canada has completed an assessment of BPA just about 1 year ago. FDA, you probably know that FDA has a review in progress, and we expect to hear some results from FDA, some conclusions very soon, perhaps even this week. In Europe, both the European Commission and the European Food Safety Authority, which is kind of like FDA in Europe, they have both separately completed their comprehensive reviews. We've also seen individual reviews from European countries such as Germany, Denmark, France, the Netherlands, and Switzerland. Going back a few more years, about 4 or so years, Japan published their comprehensive review. And earlier this year, the Food Safety Agency in Australia and New Zealand published their views on bisphenol A. And so although there is quite a bit of controversy and concern about BPA, each of these agencies, every single one, based on their review of the science, has found that products made from BPA are safe, consumer products of the type that I mentioned earlier. And there's a couple of quotes that I like to use to summarize the findings from these many reviews. And the first is from Health Canada. This is from just 1 year ago when they released their final report. And I like this quote because it's actually one of the best written, plain, simple English quotes that is based on a very complex scientific report. What they said, and this is on their website, they said, quote, "The current research tells us the general public need not be concerned. In general, most Canadians are exposed to very low levels of bisphenol A, therefore it does not pose a health risk." And then they went on further to say, with respect to infants, that, quote, "The science tells us that exposure levels are below those that could cause health effects." So very simple, plainly stated quotes from Canada. In the U.S., as I mentioned, FDA is now in the process of finishing up a review on BPA. Earlier this year, though, back in February, what they said is, quote, "With regard to BPA generally, based on all available evidence, the consensus of regulatory agencies in the United States, Canada, Europe, and Japan is that the current levels of exposure to BPA through food packaging do not pose an immediate health risk to the general population, including infants and young children." So we'll hear more from FDA soon, perhaps even this week, but that was their view as of early this year, and it's been a consistent view that they've had over the years as they have monitored the science on BPA. So although I won't get into the details of the science, not too far into the details, there are several items that I think are worth discussing for a couple of minutes just to highlight some of the key reasons why these regulatory agencies have all reached such clear conclusions on the safety of BPA. So if you think about safety assessments or risk assessments, typically those assessments will include data from several key areas of science. And one of the most important ones for BPA is the science of metabolism and pharmacokinetics. That's very important because that kind of data tells us how BPA is processed in the body. So if you're exposed to BPA, where does it go in the body? Is it metabolized? How long does it stay in the body? And then how do we get rid of it? How do we eliminate it from the body once it gets in? And here we have studies, I believe it's four studies, on adult human volunteers, all treated with a measured amount of BPA. And each of these studies demonstrates some very important features. After oral exposure to BPA, which is the way that people are predominantly exposed, BPA is essentially completely metabolized as it's being absorbed from the gut. As it goes through the intestinal wall and then to the liver, it's essentially completely metabolized. So what enters the body isn't BPA itself, but rather it's a metabolite of BPA, and that metabolite, it's the glucuronide, a conjugate of BPA, the glucuronide, has been tested by itself and shown to not be estrogenic. So this metabolic process eliminates this weak estrogenicity, the weak biological activity of BPA. And it turns out then that metabolite is then rapidly eliminated from the body. We excrete it exclusively into urine, and the half-life in the body is about 4 to 6 hours. It comes out very quickly after we are exposed. So that efficient metabolism and rapid elimination, they're very important because those properties significantly limit the potential for BPA to be harmful in the body. And I think if this were the only information we had on BPA, we probably wouldn't be very interested in it because we would predict that it would have very low toxicity. And although it has been suggested, not demonstrated experimentally, but suggested that infants or young children may not have that same capability as adults to metabolize and eliminate BPA, and thus might be a more sensitive subpopulation, we do know from a study published late last year by researchers from Harvard and CDC that even premature infants have the capability and ample capacity to metabolize BPA at the low levels to which they might be exposed. And that's very important data. I think we're going to see more of that in the future. But what we know now is very important because it suggests that infants are not necessarily more sensitive to BPA. They do seem to have the capability to metabolize BPA, very similar to the capability of adults. The second area of science that is covered in the government safety assessments is the science of toxicology. And here's where I think it gets a lot more confusing, and this is what you typically hear about in the media. So as I mentioned before, there are many hundreds of studies on BPA in laboratory animals, but these studies are not all created equal. They vary quite a bit, very vastly, in size, in scope, quality of research, and most importantly, relevance to human health. So given this avalanche of data, I think it's not advisable to really rely on any single study to assess the potential for BPA to cause health effects. And in particular for BPA, that's not advisable because they're not consistent. So it's important to evaluate all of the available and relevant data and weigh the evidence to reach any kind of a reliable conclusion. And that is indeed what government agencies do when they evaluate BPA. They look at all of the relevant data, not just a single study or two. So across studies, it's important to assess repeatability of findings, in particular repeatability in independent labs, to look for corroboration of findings among similar studies. Do you get a similar result consistently in similar studies? And then looking for consistency across the full set of data. Does it really hang together into a single coherent pattern? Or on the other hand, does it look more like random data? And it turns out that for BPA in general, there is a lack of repeatability in a number of cases where researchers have tried to repeat another researcher's study as exactly as they can. They haven't been able to repeat the finding that was originally reported. Similarly, there's poor corroboration of findings across studies. And so I wouldn't say that necessarily it's a random set of data, but it is certainly quite inconsistent. When you look at all of the data that's available, you do not get a consistent pattern at all. And partly for that reason, government agencies have not found this large data set on BPA to be very compelling. So the third area of research, and this is where I'll finish, has to do with human exposure. So for any substance, there's no possibility of harm if you're not exposed to that substance. But conversely, if you are exposed, the potential for harm is then determined by the level of exposure. We have quite a bit of data on human exposure to BPA, and the best data comes from the U.S. CDC's population scale biomonitoring program, which currently measures the presence of somewhere over 300 chemicals, one of which is BPA, in people ranging from age 6 on up. You may be aware of this program. It's an ongoing program called the National Health and Nutrition Examination Survey, or NHANES. It not only measures biomonitoring data, but a very wide range of other health parameters. So if you've heard about this, you probably have heard that BPA has been found by CDC in more than 90% of people in the U.S. Well, if you've heard that, that's pretty much true, but the most important information from the CD study is missing in what you typically hear. First, it's not BPA that is actually found, but it's that metabolite that I mentioned before, and that makes a very big difference because the metabolite has no known biological activity, whereas BPA itself is weakly estrogenic. And second, it's not the frequency of detection that really matters, but it's the levels, how much is present. And it turns out that from the first set of data published by CDC, this is data collected in 2003 and 2004, that data indicates that human exposure to BPA is about 1,000 times below the safe level, the safe intake level that was reaffirmed last year by the European Food Safety Authority. So there's a large margin of safety based on how much people are actually exposed to versus that safe level established in Europe. And to put a number on that, many of you being, or I think all of you being medical professionals, you would probably be able to grasp this, whereas journalists probably wouldn't. But the typical level of exposure, human exposure to BPA, is about, or it's probably now less than 50 nanograms per kilogram of body weight per day. And based on the 2005-2006 data, which has just been released by CDC, it appears that human exposure has probably dropped a little bit from that value. But back in from the 2003-2004 data set, typical exposure is about 50 nanograms of BPA per kilogram of body weight per day. And in addition, CDC found only slight differences between different age groups and different demographic groups. So if you look at all of the different groups that they examined, the range of exposure is only covering a factor of about 2, from the highest exposed group to the lowest exposed group. So there's not a lot of difference. It is true, based on CDC's data, that children's exposure is slightly higher than older age groups, but again, it's only a factor of about 2 from the highest to the lowest group. So that's where I wanted to finish here, by just concluding that the safety of bisphenol A in consumer products is supported by a very extensive scientific database and also supported by the conclusions of many government bodies around the world that have reviewed the science. So I'll stop there and hope that I haven't worn out my welcome by talking too long.
No, that was great, Steve. I really appreciated that overview. Now we're going to turn to Dr. Steve Novella for some comments and questions.
Thanks, Val, and thanks for having me join you on this podcast. So that was an excellent summary of the research, and you know, this is not an area of research for me. My job is to try to distill this kind of science and explain it to the public, and I found the BPA controversy, if you will, to be particularly challenging because there's just so much data, and a lot of it is conflicting, and you have to really break it down to a lot of different sub-questions. One thing I like to point out is that the most definitive type of data is the one type of data that we never get with toxicology of these kind of exposures, namely a prospective, you know, double-blind controlled data. We can't expose humans to different levels of BPA deliberately and see what happens to them. So we have to infer toxicity from multiple other different lines of evidence. And Steve did an excellent job of going over those various lines of evidence. However, the public, I think, is still left with often a confusion over this issue, because it's easy for a single study to make it seem like there's risk when it's not put into context of the hundreds of other studies that are out there. So, for example, a recent study looking at industrial exposure. This is now we're talking about observational studies where you're just essentially assessing the level of exposure in people and also assessing the prevalence of various medical problems and seeing if there's any correlation. These type studies can never prove cause and effect. It's really just looking for again, as I said, a correlation. But when you do these kind of studies, you can find these correlations. Again, one recent study looked at industrial exposure to BPA and found that men who were exposed, who worked in factories where they were getting exposed, had a higher incidence of sexual dysfunction than those who were working in a factory where there was no exposure to BPA, and there seemed to be a dose response correlation, at least in this data set. Steve, I'm not sure if you've had a chance to look at that study, for example. That was published just last month.
Yes, I have. Did you want a couple of comments on that?
Yeah, sure. Can you comment on that?
Just a couple of quick things. One is that the exposure levels experienced by those workers are vastly higher than what consumers are exposed to. That's not to say we're not concerned about the workers. They're certainly as important as consumers. But the data presented in that paper published just a few weeks ago and supplemented by data published by the same researchers a couple months earlier indicate that some of those workers are likely being exposed to BPA at levels that are probably well over 1,000 times higher than any consumer would be exposed to. And even perhaps more important is that the workers are exposed to BPA in the form of a dust. That's a solid is the normal form for BPA itself. And what that means is they're inhaling or getting it on their skin. That's quite different from ingesting BPA. Recall that we talked about how BPA is metabolized when it's ingested as it is being absorbed into the body. Of course, that metabolic process is bypassed if it is absorbed after ingestion or through the skin. So the study, I think, is an interesting study. It's not clear that it has any real relevance for consumers. It's also not clear what relevance it has for workers in other places. Given the exposure data that was presented by those researchers, it's a little bit hard to imagine that those workers were even using personal protective equipment as they should be in an industrial environment. So there are some questions there that are raised. Not really clear, though, what it means for other workers.
Yeah, I completely agree. The exposure level there was much greater than, by orders of magnitude, than what we would expect from consumer exposure to BPA. But that's the kind of data that then gets out there in the public and can be very misleading, in fact, unless you drill down to specific details. I see, again, looking at how people look at the evidence, there may be a difference in those who are emphasizing more of the epidemiological evidence and those who are emphasizing the toxicological evidence, because there have been times when toxicologists have reviewed the literature and said there is some reason for concern here, but they were focusing on the type of evidence where you're looking at the effects of BPA, for example, on in the petri dish or the test tube. And sure, yeah, it does have toxic effects like pretty much any chemical, and it does have pharmacological estrogen-like effects. And you can see a lot of potential biological effects of the substance itself, and that may raise cause for concern. But if you look at the epidemiological data, it doesn't really substantiate that there is actual harm occurring in people. And then, of course, you look at the animal data, where I think there's more mixed results, where you can see in some studies there are effects even at low doses that are below the safety levels. But then again, there may be significant metabolic differences between rats and humans, for example, in terms of how they metabolize BPA. So I think the animal data causes a lot of confusion as well. You didn't talk too much about that, but is it your impression that the animal data is often misleading with this chemical?
Well, it can be. Separate from the questions about repeatability and consistency of the data, the laboratory animals that are most commonly used are rodents, whether it's rats or mice. And there's a very important difference in how rodents process BPA versus how people process it. People ingest it and metabolize it and excrete it entirely through urine. Once it's out, it's gone. That doesn't happen quite the same way in rodents. Rodents primarily excrete BPA through the bile. It gets back into the intestinal tract where it can then be reabsorbed. That's that's called an enterohepatic recirculation. And so BPA in rodents has a much longer half-life than it does in people. And that's a very significant difference that could have a big impact on whether rodents are more or less sensitive to BPA compared to humans. They could be more sensitive. touching a little bit on the epidemiology, there are about 10 or 15 studies, epidemiological studies, most of them very small scale, and essentially all of them being cross-sectional studies, meaning that whatever the health effect under a study, that was measured or recorded at the same time that the BPA exposure was measured. And BPA exposure is typically measured by the same way that CDC does it, by measuring the presence of the metabolite in urine. The problem with a cross-sectional study, in particular for BPA, is there's no way to really know what was the exposure during the time period when the disease was developing. So, for example, you might have heard about a study last year reporting that BPA is associated with heart disease and diabetes. However, the BPA, because it has a very short half-life, there's no way to know what the BPA exposure was back in the time frame when heart disease or diabetes was developing in those people. So that type of a cross-sectional study really doesn't give you a lot of information. It's not really possible to demonstrate cause-effect in that kind of a study. And at this point, we really don't have any properly designed epidemiological studies that will give us better information.
Mm-hmm. Right. And in fact, the difference in how different people or institutions evaluate the evidence itself has been looked at, and it seems that one critical difference is how you evaluate the effects of very low doses of BPA. And I understand your position, and I agree with that. I think the evidence supports the notion that at these very low doses, it's far below the safety levels and what's been established. But there are others who have a different opinion. And how do they arrive at that opinion that even in extremely low quote-unquote toxic doses, there could be important biological effects?
I think maybe the difference is in how different people evaluate large bodies of data. Do they do it one study at a time, or do they look across the full set of data, looking for repeatability and coherency and consistency? If you look at one study at a time, you can get just about any answer you want. And that's why, but because there is so much conflicting data, that's a very dangerous thing to do in either direction. If you look at one study only and draw a conclusion that it's harmful or not, you're missing most of the data and potentially getting a very wrong answer. But what is important is to look at all of the data, looking for that consistency. Do you get the same result if you try to repeat the same experiment, in particular in an independent lab? Do you get similar results in similar experiments? And when you look at that, the full set of data that way, you find you don't get repeatability, you don't get corroboration from study to study, you're not getting consistency across the full data set. So that's what leads us, and also I think government agencies, that's one of the factors that leads us to conclude that BPA hasn't been shown to cause health effects in laboratory animals.
Is there one type of study you think that has not been done yet that you would like to see done, or are you happy with the literature as it is now?
Well, there's always more research that can be done, and in fact, our organization continues to support research ourselves. What we try to do is look for these uncertainties or open scientific questions where additional research can be helpful, and then we look to see if we can design a study that that might fill that data gap or answer the question. I don't know if there's just any single thing that I would highlight as needing attention, but there are so many different claims about what the types of health effects that BPA may cause. There's a lot of room for more research to answer these open questions, resolve uncertainty. But you have to keep in mind that each new study really adds on to or builds on to this large database that we already have. So to me, it doesn't seem too likely that one more new study is suddenly going to change everything in regard to how BPA is metabolized in the body and its potential to cause toxicity. But nevertheless, there's always more research that we can do to look into these claims about BPA.
But there's no gaping hole in the kinds of studies that have been done.
I don't think gaping hole, no, a lot, not really, but there's always more detail, more specific experiments. There's always more you can do. But I wouldn't say there are gaping holes in the database.
And just to reinforce your point, because this is the point I make to medical students when I'm teaching them as well, is that you really can't interpret a single study. You have to interpret the literature. You have to look for the signal that's peaking up above the noise. You know, something what you're saying is if you're down in the noise, you can basically come to almost any conclusion you want. But if you look for the signals, it really isn't there. There's no signal of any adverse effect in the public from BPA.
I would agree to that. That's the repeatability and corroboration across the data set. That's very important.
Okay, Val, maybe we should open it up for questions.
Okay, great. Now we're going to open up to the audience members, and I'm going to call you by name and see if you have a question that you'd like to ask either Steve. I'm going to start with David Kroll. Do you have a question?
Yes, I do, actually. Can you hear me?
Yes.
Okay, great. So Steve, I'm a toxicologist who works in the pharmacology area, and I've actually been following BPA for almost about 10 years, just sort of as a sidelight. I don't do any work on it. But I remember back around 1998, 99 or so, there was a paper with some folks down here in North Carolina, Chemical Industry Institute of Toxicology and Duke University, showing that estradiol and BPA, they both act as agonists at the estrogen receptor. I believe this is known as transfected estrogen receptor alpha. And although BPA was, as you said, you know, far less potent than estradiol, I think it was almost 100-fold less potent, they interact with receptor at different sites on the receptor. And so this is a long way of asking the question, is there concern about the cooperative or potentially synergistic effects of BPA with estradiol, even with these low-level exposures that we see in humans? Is there a concern that there might be some additive or synergistic estrogenic effects, even though the BPA alone may not be toxic itself?
Well, that concept of additivity, that's a very active area of research right now, not just specific to BPA, but really thinking about all the different substances that we are exposed to at the same time, and is there any potential for them to add together, even if all of them are at a very low level? Could they add up to something that could be harmful? For BPA specifically, there's a couple points that I think are important. One is that BPA is something like 10,000 times less potent than estradiol itself. So it does have very weak estrogenicity. But then maybe even more important is that estrogenicity is extinguished when BPA is absorbed into the body. It is metabolized primarily to the glucuronide, also to some extent to a sulfate, but both of those have been tested separately and shown to not be estrogenic. So what's actually in the body does not appear to have any biological activity, any capability to interact with estradiol or any other system in the body. So although theoretically what you say is something to look into, I think the data would suggest that that's not really a concern.
We'll go to Dr. Brian Bartabedian. Do you have a question?
Can you guys hear me?
We sure can. Thanks.
I just had a couple of comments, and then I just had a question. First off, I think it's important to understand that a lot of these studies in laboratory animals have been done with the intravenous administration of BPA, which completely changes things, as was discussed with glucuronidation. Secondly, what's happening in the marketplace is very interesting with regard to BPA because there's a whole cottage industry that's evolved of BPA-free products, and a lot of the changes that we're seeing happening are market-driven changes, so it's really confusing for the consumers. I do have a question that, you know, based upon the NTP brief, the National Toxicology Program brief that came out in last year. I mean, this is just a statement from page 37. I just would ask you guys what you think of this. It's just a sentence or two, but it says the scientific evidence that supports a conclusion of some concern for exposures in fetuses, infants, and children comes from a number of laboratory animal studies reporting that low-level exposure to bisphenol A during development caused changes in behavior in the brain, prostate gland, mammary gland, and the age at which females attain puberty. I mean, and this is tricky because it's hard for the public to read this and not have some concern. I mean, so how do you respond to that? Do you say that the low levels of the report in these studies can't be compared to humans, or how do you handle that?
I'll jump in first. You actually said a couple of key words there, some concern. The way NTP does these reports is they boil their conclusions all down into five different concern levels, ranging from serious concern or concern at the top. Some concern is in the middle, and then minimal and negligible concern are the bottom levels. And for two of those areas, one of which was behavior and the other was at prostate, two of them they flagged as some concern. And if you just take the plain English there, some concern means you ought to be concerned, right? But you have to really read through the entire report to realize what that means. And what they're saying, if you read through it, is that there's only a limited amount of data in those areas. And while that data is insufficient to really draw a conclusion one way or the other, it's also insufficient to dismiss the concern that there could be something there. And so what they're primarily saying is that more research is really needed to resolve whether there really is concern or whether there really isn't concern. So it's more of a flag for additional research. And in one of those areas, behavioral effects, there are a couple of studies just coming out that will add significantly to the database. One is a study that was just published a few weeks ago by US EPA researchers down in Research Triangle Park. And what they did is a very high-quality study looking at a variety of potential health effects, but in particular looking at some key behavioral parameters. What they found is that low doses of BPA did not cause any effects on any of these parameters, but in particular on the behavioral parameters. Another study that hasn't been published but will be soon is one that we sponsored, and it's a study following the OECD guideline for developmental neurotoxicity studies. That study looked at a very wide range of doses of BPA and found no effects on behavior at all. So if you go back again to what NTP really was saying is there's not a lot of data here, but we can't dismiss the possibility. We're going to see more data coming out. So for that area in particular, we're seeing a couple of very important studies coming out. The other areas that you mentioned or that they mentioned, I think we're going to see more data coming out as well. But at this point, it's a lack of definitive data, I think, that led to those conclusions of some concern from NTP.
Yeah, just to reinforce that, we encounter this in multiple contexts where scientists are making statements that are very conservative and that are strictly interpreting what the data does and does not show. And we make statements such as the effect that the data does not show an effect, but it can't be ruled out either by this data, or there can always be an effect that's smaller than the power of the studies so far to detect it. So that's a kind of sciencey way of describing the statistics involved in the data that we have. But the public hears that, and they often just hear, oh, well, we can't rule out that there's a problem, and therefore we need to be concerned about it. And, again, we run into this time and time again with vaccines, with, you know, mercury amalgam in teeth. You know, anytime when there's a controversy over potential human exposure to a toxin. And also, you know, this raises the issue that with, you know, many of these things, like with BPA, yeah, you can find biological and toxic effects when you look for them. And this gets, again, to the many, many different types of data that we are looking at. But I think that one take-home lesson is that we always need to look at the ultimate effect on actual people in the real world. Because otherwise, no matter how many pieces of the toxicity chain you put together, if you're missing even one, like, well, it's not actually getting absorbed into the body, then all the other pieces really don't add up to anything. And the best way to see if all of those pieces add up is to see what's happening to human biological systems, you know, when they get exposed to it. And there, I think, is where the data is most reassuring. And what I was referring to before was the fact that when you focus on that data, we actually do not see a signal of toxicity in people. But if you look at the preclinical or, you know, animal or preclinical data, there's all this mixed findings that you can find reasons for concern if you look at it. Well, and oftentimes the way I would interpret a reason for concern is just what was said. That means this needs to be studied further. It doesn't necessarily mean that products need to be taken off of shelves or there's actual proof or evidence that toxicity has occurred.
Excellent points. I'm going to turn to Dr. Harriet Hall to see if she has a question.
Yes, so often when we try to fix something, it turns out that the cure is worse than the disease. I wondered if you could comment on what the consequences would be of trying to avoid products with BPA.
That's a tough question because there's a variety of different products that are BPA-free that are on the market. And invariably, though, we know far less about them than we do about products made from BPA. As I mentioned early on in my introductory discussion, BPA is one of the best tested of all substances. We have this huge scientific database. You don't have that for much of anything else. So I've always thought it's curious that products are being marketed on the basis of what they're not. In other words, they're BPA-free, but not marketed on the basis of what they are. And in fact, consumers usually don't even know what the alternatives are, much less how much data is available for it. So it's difficult to say what implications there might be. I can't say that alternative products are harmful. I have no basis to say that at all. But I think it is certainly the case that BPA has been far more well tested than essentially any other alternative that would be on the market today.
Okay. Gene Ostrovsky, do you have a question?
I was wondering whether there's a greater risk from BPA in medical devices, specifically things that are invasive or ventilator tubes or catheters that might carry the substance into the body.
Yeah, that's a very good question, and that touches on part of what FDA is doing. FDA is looking at the safety of BPA in all FDA-regulated products, whether they are food containers or any product that contacts food, but also, most importantly, medical devices. And the potentially significant difference is that food contact means we're ingesting BPA, and that means it's metabolized as it's being absorbed, as we've discussed a couple of times earlier. But for medical devices, or some of them anyway, BPA will not be ingested, but it can get into the bloodstream from use of the medical device. So that's a different situation. The BPA will be metabolized as soon as it gets to the liver. It's going to be metabolized and then excreted, but it does get into the body as BPA itself. So FDA is looking into that. I don't think we're going to hear about that in the next week or so. That's a conclusion we're going to hear somewhat later. FDA is doing that at a slower pace. I don't think there's any evidence, though, that the levels of BPA that would come from a medical device could be harmful. They're also not typically, they would not be exposures that are occurring day in and day out as the BPA that comes in with our food. So there's no evidence that BPA is causing health effects in people from use of medical devices, but that's an area where I think more research and more investigation is going to be needed.
Okay. Do you have an idea for how common BPA is in medical devices?
I don't know how to put it in context. It is polycarbonate plastic in particular is commonly used in medical devices. I don't know how to say how commonly, but it is a common material that is used. Think about the attributes of it. It's clear and very highly shatter resistant, so it has the durability and the capability to be reused. So it is fairly commonly used.
Okay, thank you very much. And let's go to Barbara Ficarro.
Oh, hi, Val. Thanks. Hi. Yes. Hi. My question is actually more in simplified terms for the general public. I hear a lot of feedback actually from listeners and from readers about the effects of plastics, and their concern is that they shouldn't be drinking water bottles that have been in the freezer, and they shouldn't be using plastics that have been in the microwave or drinking out of water bottles that were left overnight in their cars. Actually, an email had circulated at the hospital, and everyone was up in arms over this, and they are throwing their water bottles out, and they're getting all the aluminum cans now. And so I think in more simplified terms for the public, I understand what you're saying about using the studies in a vast majority and going through each one, not just singling one out. But I think when it comes to the public, I think that's what happens. They're just focusing on one thing, and it's leading to panic almost. So what can be done actually in terms of letting them know, you know, that it's safe for them at this point because the studies are all revealing that it is safe?
That's a tough one because it is a lot easier to generate fear than to reassure somebody with a thorough analysis of abstract scientific data. You know, we this is not our human psychology. We tend to be much more compelled by just a story. And certainly when we pick up on the fear of people around us, just an evolved survival instinct. If other people are concerned or afraid about something, it's better to be safe than sorry, we reason, and therefore we pick up on that fear right away. The only thing, you know, we could do as science bloggers, medical bloggers, is to try to get the real information out there and to try to calm people down with, you know, a more, again, rational or science-based analysis of all the evidence. And that can have an effect. I mean, there are some people who do want to know the actual truth. It's also, I think, important to emphasize that there's no risk-free thing to do, right? I mean, life is not risk-free. And as a previous question alluded to, if you say, okay, I'm not going to drink water out of plastic bottles anymore, I'm going to use aluminum cans, I'm sure you could find just as scary stories about the risks of aluminum. There are, in fact, information tying aluminum to Alzheimer's disease. Again, hasn't been established. It's probably safe, but that data may even be at a slightly higher concern level than the BPA data. So I'd hate to trade one unreasonable fear for another, but you have to, I guess you could help people understand that just overreacting to every bit of information that they may pick up from the media may not be in their best interest.
And I can echo that. You said a couple of keywords, getting the real data out there. That's a real challenge, too, because, for example, one of the true myths that you mentioned was about frozen water bottles. Don't put a water bottle in the freezer. That's a total myth. There's no factual data for that one at all, but that myth has been circulating, I think, for years now. So you're doing a great service to your readers to try to get the real data out there. It's a big challenge, though, to really sort out which are the ones that are total myths and which are ones that might have a kernel of truth, but just don't have complete information or don't have the right context. And regarding people making decisions based on these myths, in addition to the better safe than sorry sentiment, which we probably all have, the other one I try to think about is look before you leap. You might be jumping into something that's worse than what you're jumping away from.
Hi, this is Tony Brayer. But, you know, I have to push back a little bit because you talk about, as if the consumer or the public is just responding to fear tactics. But even the, NIH brought together people as recently as October 2009, just a couple of months ago, and the National Toxicology Program, which I presume is a branch of the NIH, I don't know, but they are saying they looked at all the recent data and are advising people to be cautious and not heat up plastic in the microwave. And, you know, I wouldn't consider that a scaremongering organization. So this is what people are seeing. This is what our patients are seeing.
Yeah, I'm not sure in October that might have been the gathering of scientists related to a recent grant program from NIEHS, and the scientists, many of the scientists who participated in that are ones who are propagating some of these scares or some of these stories about BPA. I don't think what you heard necessarily is from NIEHS, but I don't know for sure what you've seen, so I can't say for certain.
But you do raise a point that there are organizations of scientists who are making statements about this. It's not all just media scaremongering, and I agree. I think that gets back to the fact that there's a lot of complexity in this data, and you could look at it from different perspectives. And I think very well-meaning organizations may have taken a narrow sort of view of this evidence. And also, there's no completely objective place to draw lines for safety. There's always a judgment call involved in terms of what is an appropriate margin of safety. And therefore, there's some wiggle room for judgment or for perspective, and that's why I think there's often maybe a slight range of opinion about things like this. What we do find if we look at all of the agencies who have sounded off on this scientific data is actually a pretty good consensus that we are well below a good buffer safety margin with BPA, and having some minority dissenters is good. I mean, I think that's always good for any science, but they're always there. I mean, it's and the fact that they are there doesn't mean that there's any necessary legitimacy to that position, but it does absolutely generate confusion in the public, and the media, I think, often will give equal weight to a lone minority opinion versus a robust consensus without necessarily putting it in the context of where the bulk of the opinion and the evidence lies.
Okay, I think we have time for probably just two more questions. I might miss some of our audience members' questions. I'm so sorry about that, but these have been fascinating. Let's go to Phil Bauman. Do you have a question, Phil?
Sure. My question isn't so much medical related, but more kind of the economics of safety. For the sake of argument, if we were to find out that BPA was in fact dangerous, do we have any numbers for what the either in the United States or globally, what the economic impact of that is? We have a dollar figure of just how consequential BPA is.
You mean in terms of the economics of the materials itself and all the products made?
Well, let's say the FDA all of a sudden decided, you know, we're gonna ban BPA. What would be the economic consequences of that? Do we have any dollar figures of what that would entail? And I expect you probably wouldn't have those numbers, but I'm just kind of getting to how large of an economic issue is.
I don't have any specific numbers, but if you think about where BPA is used, it is used in some very important applications. For example, maybe the most notable one is that the epoxy resins are used as the protective coating on most food and beverage cans. So that's a very, very important application for what it does there, protecting the safety of food. But that also means it's not going to be easy to replace or I suppose, inexpensive. But I have no specific data on the economics.
Yeah, I guess, yeah, just, and I didn't expect you would because it's probably a hard number to figure out, but just sort of sometimes when it comes to these public debates, that gets lost in the shuffle of how to think about public safety. And I think if people understood just how kind of ubiquitous this is and that that a decision like this is not a light decision to make, especially when the evidence seems to point that we're talking about a very, very low risk profile. I was just curious if there was any information about that because it just seems to be such a huge product that's sort of embedded in so many different areas.
Right.
All right, that's fine.
Dr. Leap, do you have a question real quick?
Well, I have a question for Dr. Novella. I think I wondered what his thoughts were because I think we're at an interesting place culturally where we like to think that we're very scientific. But oftentimes, when we present people with things that seem to reassure in sciences, they reject them out of hand as conspiratorial, or they almost seem to be seeking some sort of what I was thinking of a homeopathic response curve. They think, well, it's a tiny dose, so it must be bad. And the thing is, this isn't most of my patients. Of course, I'm in the emergency room, so most people aren't concerned about this exposure. But if I have two subsets, people who would never understand the data, but then there are coworkers of mine. And many of whom are very concerned about this. I microwaved some leftover Chinese the other day, and you would have thought I killed a kitten. They were so concerned with me. They were like, why would you do that? It's so dangerous. And I'm convinced that some of these folks, if I presented them with this data that said, well, you know, it's really not a concern, they would just laugh and say, well, that's whatever you think, but I'm still going to avoid it. So it's almost like we have a bimodal distribution of understanding of science. Can Dr. Novella comment on that, where we are culturally with that? Because some people simply, even as they call themselves scientific, reject those things out of hand when they have a concern about a thing?
That's actually kind of a complicated question, but certainly there is an anti-establishment undercurrent in our culture. That's certainly in the United States especially. I think there's people take a certain amount of pride almost in being individualistic and counter-authoritarian, you know, we don't listen to the man, nobody tells us what to do or what the truth is. So it's easy for that to turn into not believing the scientific establishment or the medical establishment. And it's also easy to imagine a conflict of interest for anything that you're told. Just as the previous questioner noted, Yeah, there would be, like we can't maybe put an exact number on it, but there'd be a multi-billion dollar price tag associated with just suddenly banning BPA, and people can use that as an excuse to dismiss the evidence, the scientific evidence, to say, well, it's all just an industry put-up job. And I do think that people will casually assume such conflicts of interest and even big conspiracies, and it's a little bit harder to reach them because they're basically saying, I will reject ad hoc any evidence that contradicts what I want to believe. And it gets very difficult to penetrate those people. I do think that one way to mitigate that is to have a really high degree of transparency and to avoid even the minute appearance of conflict whenever possible. I mean, it's impossible, I think, to eliminate it completely. You know, you're working and functioning in the real world. You're going to have contacts that could potentially be looked at with a sinister lens. But we could at least minimize the appearance of conflicts and have, replication and independent scientific bodies review data. And at least we could reassure the more rational, end of that bimodal distribution.
Sure. Thank you.
You've been listening to a podcast interview with Dr. Steve Henches and Dr. Steve Novella about bisphenol A and plastic products. I'm Dr. Val Jones, founder of GetBetterHealth.com.